Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by Dennis Barron, author of What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She. He's Professor Emeritus of English and Linguistics at the University of Illinois. He's been published many places for his commentaries on language and even co-written an amicus brief to the U.S. Supreme Court on the Second Amendment. That interpretation was part of the major Heller decision by the nation's high court. It's a pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk.
Great to be here, Larry.
So you start with the history of the gendered pronoun and the challenge this is presented in the language going back for centuries. How far back do we have a debate over how we refer to people?
Well, the debate seems to start toward the end of the 18th century. So it goes back a couple of centuries. It's a couple of hundred years old. And it's still going on today.
What were the precipitators for the debate back then?
Well, back then the idea was, does the pronoun, the generic masculine, for example, does it include women? Is it inclusive or is it exclusive? Does it mean only men? And what do you do when you are talking about a person or a referent whose gender you don't know? Gender's unknown. Or what do you do when the gender of the person you're talking about is totally irrelevant? What pronoun should you use?
And was there a widely held belief that using the masculine was sufficient to describe humankind, using mankind, or he, meaning either he or she?
Well, that's the idea that grammarians had been putting forth since the 16th century, trying to apply a Latin rule of how to make adjectives and nouns agree to English. And the only place where gender really plays a role in English now is in the pronoun system with the third person, he, she, and it. And so they said, well, you know, if you're talking about people in general, use he. And more often than not, people had a little problem with that because, well, what about this case? Does this mean women too? Or what about this case? Is this inclusive? Is this just men? And so they quickly came upon the realization that it was not maybe the ideal solution.
Was this embedded in the debate over suffrage for women, how the language referred to women?
Well, it starts to appear in the 19th century when we're talking about suffrage. Yes, absolutely. The generic he was made into law in England in 1850, in Canada in 1867, in the U.S. in 1871. All three countries passed laws which basically said when he or man occurs in a statute, it's inclusive. It includes women. He includes she. And so suffragists, both in the U.S. and in the U.K., seized on that, and they said, look, if he in the criminal code refers to a perpetrator, and it could be either a man or a woman, if a woman commits a crime, she can be tried, convicted, punished for that crime, even though the law refers to the lawbreaker as he. Well, then what about the voting law? If he in the voting law, that must mean women can vote. And they put forth this argument. Susan B. Anthony in 1872 told a suffragist meeting in Illinois this very thing. She said, look, we got to be consistent. If you say he does not mean women can vote, then he does not mean women can be punished in the criminal law. If a wife commits murder, she said, let the husband be hung for it.
We're talking with Dennis Barron, Professor Emeritus, University of Illinois, author of What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She. When do we have the first recorded use of a gender-neutral pronoun?
Well, singular they, used to refer to a person of either gender, starts to appear in writing in English in 1375. That's a really, really long time ago, centuries and centuries old. In written English, it's got to have been in the spoken language a bit before that. That's usually the pattern, writing copy speech. And it's used, singular they, is used by well-respected authors, Chaucer, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, Dickens, all down the centuries without batting an eye.
Is it used, though, with a specific individual in mind, or is it used as a generic reference term for an undetermined number of people?
Well, it starts to appear as an indefinite for a member of a class. Everybody forgets his passwords. But it also refers to a single individual whose identity may or may not be known. For example, you would say today, oh, you got a phone call, and did they leave a message? Obviously, it's one person who made the call, but we refer to that person as a they. You start seeing in more recent usage in English, they being used for a specific named individual. Alex likes their burger medium well.
And that's, been somewhat controversial to use that with people saying that grammatically for a specific, as you said, named individual, that's grammatically incorrect. What's your thought on that?
Okay, so nobody cared about the grammar of singular they until the 18th century when grammarians started writing up these rules about what you could and couldn't say, what you could and couldn't write. And they started to indicate that singular they, whether for an indefinite or a known person, was ungrammatical because they is plural and the referent, everybody, Alex, whatever, is singular and you can't use a plural pronoun for a singular noun. But that's actually not the way language works. The example I give is you. You is plural. You has always been plural in English. And starting in the 17th century, you started to double as a singular pronoun as well. Before that, the singular versions were thou, thee, and thy. And when you started to be used for a singular person, people complained. They said, oh, that's not grammatical. You know, you can't do that. George Fox, who was the founder of the Society of Friends, the Quakers, wrote an entire book attacking singular you. He said that anybody who uses you to refer to one person is unlettered, a fool, and an idiot. But of course, we use you to refer to one person all the time today. You don't hear too many calls for people saying, oh, I wish we could go back to thee and thou.
Thou art correct on that. Absolutely. We're talking with Dennis Barron, Professor Emeritus, University of Illinois. What's your pronoun beyond he and she? Of course, in this era when so many college students, particularly, I think that's where you most see this in the world today, announce their preferred gender pronoun as a part of introducing themselves to their professors and to their fellow students. So we're talking about the history of gendered pronouns, also about efforts to come up with gender-neutral or non-binary pronouns that people can agree on. Yes, there have been many different words that have been tried, and it seems to me that would be the ideal, to come up with a word that we think is the best that's used in lieu of he or she. But people have been trying that for a very long time. And Professor, what have been the impediments to the universal adoption of a gender-neutral pronoun?
Well, I suppose the biggest impediment is nobody can agree on which coined pronoun, which new pronoun to use, and nobody can agree on how to get everybody else to use it. I found over 200 coinages starting as early as 1841. That's the first one.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. We'll be right back. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC and KPECC.org. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by Professor Emeritus of English and Linguistics at the University of Illinois, Dennis Barron. His book is What's Your Pronoun? He's written a series of books on language and writing, including The English-Only Question, An Official Language for Americans, and A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. But right now, we turn our attention to efforts to coin specific gender-neutral or non-binary pronouns. So, Professor Barron, you were saying there was something like 200 different words tried out for this?
Yes, more than 200. And some of them are words that are already in the language. For example, in 1792, James Anderson said, well, there's a dialect pronoun that people around here use, ooh, and they use it for males, females, animals, inanimate objects. Why don't we use ooh? In 1808, Samuel Taylor Coleridge said, why don't we use it for the gender-neutral pronoun? Just you know, extended beyond inanimate objects. He, she, it, just use it for when you don't know whether you're talking about a man or a woman. And in 1841, I've got the earliest coinage I found. I bet there are earlier ones. But it's simply the letter E, E for male or female, and it was coined by a doctor. He had just gotten his MD from Yale in 1840. Apparently, practicing medicine wasn't doing it for him. And so in 1841, he wrote an English grammar book in which he simply says E for what he called the masculo-feminine gender. You have the masculine he, the feminine she, and the masculo-feminine E. And by 1842, he was selling insurance. So he was having a little problem figuring out what to
There's
do.
There's a lot
life.
Of logic behind that proposal, though, because
there is.
He takes on the sounds of both she and he. So mm-hmm. from a strictly logical standpoint, that's a great idea.
It's a great idea, and it's been invented a number of times. People argued later on, well, all the other vowels have their own word. There's A, the indefinite article, I, the first person pronoun, O, the exclamation, the letter U for the second person pronoun. So E doesn't have a slot. Let's put E in there as the gender neutral pronoun.
I understand why in Coleridge's day it didn't take on, because there's this huge division between animals and people. And so the mm-hmm. notion that people could be referred to as it, I understand why people would take offense. But nowadays, with the animal rights movement, we don't think of animals as, less than particularly. Has there been any effort to revive it, given our improved status of animals?
Not that I've noticed. Instead, people are coining terms. Somebody heard me on the radio last week and sent me a suggestion. How about vape, T-H-E-Y-P, for that person?
It sounds like vape.
yeah. People have been, some of the people who coin pronouns are a little bit, you might call them crackpots or busybodies. Some of them were well-respected, well-known, and well-educated people. For example, in 1884, Charles Converse, who was known nationally as a hymn writer, he wrote What a Friend We Have in Jesus.
Oh, sure, yeah.
He said thon, T-H-O-N. He blended that and one, and he said this would be a perfect, they called them in those days common gender pronouns. This would be a perfect gender neutral pronoun. It's efficient, it's short, it's easy to learn. And he announced it in a literary journal, and it sparked a national debate. People said, oh, I love thon. I'm going to start using thon. Other people said, I think we need a word. I hate thon. I've got a better idea. One person suggested ip, I-P. Another person, yeah. I like that one. It's kind of cute. And the argument there was the advantage for ip is, well, you know, it's sort of like it. It also has a Latin flavor. It seems like a Latin word, but it's not Latin. So you don't have to be put off by you know, a classical reference. But ip did not take off. Somebody else suggested le, borrowed from the French, L-E. Despite the fact that le in French is a masculine article, a person said, well, it would be perfect for English, absolutely perfect. You need a short word, easy to pronounce, easy to spell, unobtrusive. Pronouns shouldn't be, you know, in your face. But nobody picked up on le either.
What a friend Thon has in Jesus. I can just hear it. Just you could, Converse could have modified his hymn with his, with his pronoun.
He didn't go that far.
All right. What's your pronoun? Beyond He and She is the book by Dennis Barron, our guest, Professor Emeritus of English and Linguistics at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's also been a national commentator on language issues, NPR, Washington Post, CNN, even filing an amicus brief with the U.S. Supreme Court over the language used in the Second Amendment in an effort to guide the Heller decision in that D.C. firearms gun control case. He's talking with us about the historic efforts to come up with a gender non-binary pronoun that could be used, or gender neutral pronoun, to replace she and he, and some of the creative ways that people have come up with them over the years. One of the things I find so fascinating, Professor, is this might have been put in literary journals or academic journals, and all, but how passionately people feel about this. Even, you know, we think of non-emotive academics. They take this very seriously.
Oh, yeah. And now it's really the subject of dinner table conversation. There hardly a week goes by without seeing a story in a major news outlet about something to do with a pronoun, whether it's Sam Smith announcing the pronoun they, coming out as non-binary, using the pronouns they and them, which the Associated Press, by the way, reported in a short article, calling Sam Smith he 10 times. They rewrote the article and somebody pointed out to them, well, you know, maybe he's not the right pronoun to announce that Sam Smith is actually they. So they rewrote the article, avoiding any pronoun use whatsoever, because apparently the AP had a hard time using singular they for a known individual.
Yeah. This effort over the years of coming up with these gender-neutral pronouns, how did that extend into the law? I mean, you gave a great example of, in journalism, them wrestling with this issue. But have states looked at making changes actually in, you know, in their laws, in public documents and the like to reflect this?
Yes, and a number of states have rewritten their constitutions and drafted statutes with an eye to making them gender neutral or gender nonspecific. But instead of using a coined word and instead of using singular they, the solution that most of them, as far as I know, took was to simply repeat the noun every time you use it. The idea was, you know, if you're talking about the qualifications for the governor has to be so-and-so years old, the governor has to be a resident of the state for so many years. Each time you reference the governor, you say the governor. You don't say he, you don't say he or she, you don't say they.
All right. And Professor, do you have a sense that this is coalescing around terms, or do you feel like we're just kind of starting on this process in the era where individuals are identifying themselves as non-gender conforming or non-binary?
Well, I think obviously the discussion of trans and gender nonconforming and non-binary persons has revived interest in the pronoun issue. And it seems to me that singular they is really leading the field in terms of usage here. But I think we're going to go on for a number of years with multiple solutions to the gender-neutral, non-binary pronoun issue. Many trans persons prefer the binary pronoun of the gender that they are, and a significant number of them also choose singular they. A small number use coined pronouns, and a small number also go with the no pronoun at all. Just repeat my name every time you reference me. So that doesn't bother me. We have multiple ways of saying things in English and have had that for a long, long time. It's not really a problem to have multiple ways of dealing with the gendered pronoun issue either.
What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She? Dennis Barron is the author of the book. And right below his name on the cover of the book, it has in parentheses he, him, his. Those are his pronouns. He makes it clear on the cover of the book. We'll continue our conversation by talking about some of the other very interesting areas in which Dennis Barron has been writing. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Larry Mantle. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. We're talking with University of Illinois Professor Emeritus of English and Linguistics, Dennis Barron, author of What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She. He's also author of a number of other books that have looked at linguistic and language issues. I wanted to touch on some of the other books that you've written, Professor, including A Better Pencil, Readers, Writers, and the Digital Revolution. What are some of the ways that writers composing their work on a keyboard, where you can change it as easily as with computers, how has that changed the process from using a typewriter or years before that writing longhand?
Well, I think one of the things that we see is that more and more people are writing more and more things. It's come to everybody's an author. Everybody's a writer now. The technology has democratized who gets to write. There's still a divide, of course, between people who have computers or mobile phones or digital tablets and those in the world who do not. But the group of writers, in terms of absolute numbers and percentages of populations, has increased. And you see this with every new technological innovation that has to do with writing. It kind of expands the writer's club.
And of course, the internet has changed everything, because now for writers, they don't have to necessarily go to a research library or even a public library. With the world available to them online, the productivity of writers has increased tremendously just because of the efficiency of research time.
Right. And one of the things you notice is that every time there's this bump in the number of writers, the number of people who are engaging in writing, you get pushback from people who said, well, wait a minute, should they even be allowed to write? You know, they're writing, they're publishing, they're putting stuff online, and maybe they're not qualified. So it generates this kind of fear that expanding our literacy, expanding reading and writing capability is potentially not just liberating. Many people say, oh, yeah, it's really liberating. You get more and more people engaged in the activity, and I think that's good. But some people say, well, but it's also, you know, dangerous. These people's ideas are not being vetted. These people are not being subject to editorial censorship. We need to control this. There is a fear of letting literacy spread to the masses.
Well, and the internet, because of the informality of much of the communication there, has had an effect on our writing, has had an effect on grammar. I'd argue that it's even had an effect on how people speak, that that it's been quite dramatic. And like so many technological achievements, it's a double-edged sword, in my view.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely correct. It has pluses and minuses. The technology affects how we produce words. I think the informality is certainly present online, but language has been becoming, written language has been getting increasingly informal over the years, even before the internet, even before the computer. You look at the kinds of vocabulary people are using in their writing in the 20th century, compare that to the 19th century, less formal verbiage, shorter sentences. It's a discernible pattern.
And does that have an effect on clarity, in your view, or are they two? Is this apple and orange when you talk about informality versus clarity?
Right. It has nothing necessarily to do with clarity. You can write formally and be totally obscure.
As some people are. Very good point. We're talking with University of Illinois Professor Emeritus of English and Linguistics, Dennis Barron. His latest book, What's Your Pronoun Beyond He and She? He's also writer of The English Only Question, an official language for Americans, question mark. And Professor, of course, this was a very big issue going back just a couple of decades ago. You had governmental bodies that were considering, you know, English only, should it be the official language? Is that exclusionary? Is that condemning of people who've come from other places where English is the second language? You know, take us back a little bit to this debate over English only.
Well, the debate really begins in the founding era when people start arguing over, you know, the presence of speakers of other languages besides English, and what, you know, does that represent a problem? Should the laws be translated into languages besides English? For a long time in Louisiana, as it was a territory and became a state, laws were in English and French, and debate in the legislature was in English and French. And then there was pushback against the French, and English started to dominate. Similar phenomenon in California in the mid-19th century when it becomes a state. As it becomes a state, English and Spanish coexist, and then English sort of pushes Spanish out in terms of legal requirements. So the debate about whether English should be official, where English should be used, where minority languages should or should not be permitted, goes back a couple of hundred years. It tends to come to the fore during periods when are discussions over immigration, discussions over the rights of certain groups of individuals, things like that. So it's not a surprise that it was discussed in the 1920s when immigration reform was on the table. It's not surprising that it's being discussed post-1965 with that immigration reform and the influx of many people who spoke not just European languages, but non-European languages, people from Asia, from Africa, from the Caribbean, who are not English speakers, and from Latin America, South America, Central America, who were not really major migrants before that period.
We have just about a minute and a half left, Professor. And I also wanted to ask you, you did a book on this too, Guide to Home Language Repair, about the most frequently asked grammatical questions you get. Can you give us some of your greatest hits?
Well, people tend to call in when I did call-in shows on our local station with complaints that they expected me to ratify. And one of the most curious ones was a guy who called in and wanted me to condemn the expression "keep off the grass," and I asked him, "What would you say instead?" He didn't have an alternative, and I said, "You know, what's wrong with it?" And he couldn't explain it, but he did want me to condemn it. And basically, I said that, you know, no, you want to tell these people get a life, you know?
Well, and I'm sure you hear this all the time when people hear about your specialty, that there are a lot of grammar police officers in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I one of the many rules of usage that I've come up with, I call them Barron's Laws. Barron's Law says that everybody wants to be correct, but nobody wants to be corrected.
So true. We end on that note. Professor, thank you for being with us, talking about particularly your latest book, What's Your Pronoun? Beyond He and She. We appreciate your taking the time.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC.